Welcome to Truth vs. Hollywood. I'm David Chen.
I'm Joanna Robinson.
Truth vs. Hollywood is a look at films that are based on a true story. But we don't just talk about the film, we also talk about that true story. On this podcast, we'll touch on what really happened, how that differs from the film, and why. And we're not just talking heads, we'll hear about the true story through interviews from experts, witnesses, and people who were involved in it. So, Joanna Robinson, what movie are we talking about today?
Today we are talking about another David Fincher film, Zodiac. Of course, the film is based on the real-life investigation of the Zodiac serial killer, which took place over decades, starting in the 1960s. But this film is particularly based around the investigation done by Robert Graysmith, a cartoonist-turned-true crime journalist who is the main character of the film. Graysmith, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, is still alive as of this recording in January 2020. He didn't have a direct hand in writing the screenplay, but he had a chance to read it before filming started. It was written by James Vanderbilt. The film gained critical acclaim and is on a lot of critics' top 10 lists, but it received zero Oscar nominations. It received criticism for being very long, but it's honestly not any longer than any other film we've covered so far. It does have a stellar cast. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal as young Robert Graysmith, Robert Downey Jr. as crime reporter Paul Avery, and Mark Ruffalo as Detective David Toski.
So, John Robinson, we like to begin our episodes talking about what we thought of the movie overall, because obviously we rewatched it in preparation for this podcast. So, over a decade after this movie has come out, like, what did you think of Zodiac? And maybe tell us about what you thought of it the first time around.
Well, I don't know if everyone listening to this podcast knows that I grew up in the Bay Area of California. I still live in the Bay Area of California. So this is a film that, you know, he's very close to home. A lot of the action wraps up right around when I was born. So it's not like I had a huge overlap with the Zodiac Killer or any overlap or the fear and sort of mania surrounding it. That being said, it's really like, I don't know if you have this experience watching films that are set in your hometown, but like watching your home paper, the San Francisco Chronicle, or columnists like Herb Kane that I grew up reading, like all this sort of local flavor stuff that's in here adds an extra layer of interest for me. This is also just like a beautifully acted, beautifully directed film. It does feel long when you're watching it. And I almost, you know, as a fan of David Fincher, as a fan of the now canceled Netflix series Mindhunter, I feel like if this film came out now, it would be a 6-episode miniseries on TV. That's what it feels like to me. So
yeah, but back in 2007, the streaming world wasn't quite what it is today, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. I think this movie's a masterpiece. You know, I thought it was a masterpiece when it first came out. It felt to me like a really great movie about obsession. And I feel like that is even more relevant to today. And honestly, the thing that this movie reminded me of the most while I was watching it this time around was online fandom. I think it's a brilliant metaphor for online fandom and for, you know, people who either dissect TV and films or who have like theories about TV and films and then like spend a substantial amount of time pursuing those theories. And like that's kind of what I felt about the Graysmith character played by Jake Gyllenhaal in this movie, that he becomes so obsessed by the end of this movie. It just really reminded me of like people who need to believe something is true and will reorient their entire life around those beliefs. And so, yeah, I really love this movie. I think it's still extremely relevant for today, and you can read it as an allegory about online fandom or just a straight-up thrilling police procedural, however you want to consume it. I just found it very relevant for the things that you and I cover and discuss on a fairly regular basis, Joanna. So those are my thoughts on Zodiac. So let's get into the film itself. The movie Zodiac opens with the Zodiac's second murder, actually. A young man and woman are driving on the 4th of July. This is Darlene Farren and Michael Mageau. It's unclear if they are a couple in the film, but it does look like they are heading towards Makeout Point. Darlene is spooked by a car she recognizes, but she tells Michael not to worry about it. Then a second car pulls up and kills them by shooting through the window with a gun. So we hear who we think is the killer calling in the murder to the police, and we learn that Michael actually is still alive. He's sitting outside the car as he's found by what looks like a police officer on a motorcycle, although The police officer doesn't really seem like he's in much of a hurry to help Michael, which is a little bit odd. But this opening scene sets the tone that this will be a thriller and a murder mystery, and that Michael Mojo's story will actually become the bookends of the film.
So actually, before we go on, we should note that this was, in fact, Zodiac's second confirmed attack, and we don't actually see the first murder on film. Because there was no survivor, Fincher thought it would be less intriguing, even though it is mentioned in passing in the film. An expert on the Zodiac case, Michael Butterfield, describes that first murder.
David Faraday and Betty Lou Jensen were on their first date together. They were relaxing in David's Rambler station wagon on Lake Herman Road in the Lover's Lane spot. And they were most likely having a good time. Several other cars had driven by and seen them throughout the period of time they were sitting there. So they were probably doing what most kids were doing. They were probably fooling around a little bit and enjoying themselves and thinking that this was a pleasant night. And that was all shattered when another vehicle arrived and a man got out and opened fire on the car. What was their first date ended up being their last date. But there were no fingerprints left at the scene, no witnesses saw the killer, and only one witness got a brief glimpse of a car that was parked at the location at the time of the crime. So while they initially believed that they would solve this case quickly, after several months they discovered that not only was there no one that they could identify as a viable suspect, but that the person who was responsible for that murder was probably still out there and going to do it again.
We get to the opening credits, and the film skips to a few weeks later. Jake Gyllenhaal, playing Robert Graysmith, is a single dad driving his son to school. He sketches in the car, which tells us he's a cartoonist, and he goes to work at the San Francisco Chronicle. We also get a shot following the mail cart as it comes in, an indication that something in there is pretty important, and we meet Robert Downey Jr. as Paul Avery in the background, basking in the glory of his coworkers. We get right away that he thinks that he is a big deal.
So in this editorial meeting, the staff receives a mysterious letter, which Avery reads aloud to the room, but can't finish it himself. And they're all touching it. Get your fingerprints off the evidence. So the letter is from someone who says he's killed the couple we saw at the beginning and a second couple, and offers proof, such as number of shots, the brand of the bullets, etc. He also demands the letter be published or he'll go on a killing spree. Paul goes to confirm with Vallejo police that the details of the case are accurate, and they are, which means this guy definitely killed those people. Graysmith is clearly intrigued, but is dismissed by the editor, saying that he doesn't belong in the meeting because he's a cartoonist. They also call the other two newspapers that receive letters and have to make the decision whether to print or not. And Duffy Jennings, who was working at the newspaper at the time of some of the murders, explains their reasoning.
And the decision clearly was made then to publish at that time. Though I suspect that that decision wasn't based so much on public safety, because that wasn't a specific threat as it came in the later letters, but clearly more to see if somebody could solve the cipher, which is in fact what happened when the couple in Salinas very soon afterwards did solve the cipher, but also based on what their solution was, did not see an identity of an individual.
They decide to print the letter, but not on page one. They put it on page four. And then the San Francisco Chronicle staff retires to a bar, even though it must be 10 a.m. in the morning.
So Graysmith goes home and decides to try and break the cipher himself with the help of a code-breaking book he got from the library. The FBI and the Navy are also trying to break it, and we see a couple in California break the code at their breakfast table. And I always love Fincher films for their attention to detail, and you really get that in these opening scenes here where you see just a scene from the Navy, a scene from the FBI, and I'm just like, I always think to myself, how much did that scene require to shoot for a scene that lasts, you know, no more than 10 seconds, but it really does convey to you the scale of the law enforcement apparatus that is, like, the gears are grinding into motion as this cipher has wormed its way into these newspapers, and everyone's trying to find the Zodiac killer at this point. So anyway, back at the office, Paul introduces himself to Graysmith, and he's intrigued that Graysmith predicted correctly that the killer would refuse to divulge his name. You know, Gray Smith is dropping all these hints like, he's not going to release his name. He's not going to do it this way. You know, Gray Smith seems to have knowledge that the others don't. And so Avery wants to know what's up with that. Avery also lets him know that a couple cracked the code, but there are 18 letters that are left over at the bottom. Gray Smith immediately starts to do anagrams and Avery's further impressed. In real life, people were never actually able to make the last 18 letters into anything truly coherent. Here's cryptographer David Aranchak to talk about why that's the case.
So one of the solutions that people came up with was Robert Emmett the Hippie. And they came up with that solution by rearranging the letters in the last 18... They were rearranging the last 18 letters of the first message. But the problem with that is there are misspellings in the rearrangement. There's a missing R from Robert, there's a missing M from Emmett, and a missing P from Hippie. Another problem with it is that you can rearrange the same sequence of letters to produce other names and phrases. Another name that you can produce is Timothy E. Fibert. But you can also produce these nonsensical phrases, such as, I'm here to bite the pie, the eerie poet bit him, I ho the Tibet Empire, I better hope I tee him, and you can come up with many others. And the reason that you can come up with so many of these is because there are hundreds of millions of ways to rearrange the last 18 letters of the message. And even if only one in a million of them say something interesting, you still have many of them to pick from, so you can't know for sure if you're on the right track. So it's very speculative if you can come up with a name. It's very speculative to claim that the name has any meaning.
By the way, we should also point out in real life, Avery and Gray Smith were not really friends. They only had a few conversations when Gray Smith was researching the book, so most of their scenes together are completely made up.
So the Chronicle gets a second letter, and this time the killer calls himself Zodiac. Flash forward 2 months later in Napa at Lake Berryessa to the most disturbing scene in the entire film. A couple, Celia and Brian, are hanging out by the lakes by themselves in a completely empty area on a beautiful day. And a guy walks over with a gun wearing a mask and a hood demanding their money. So the couple is tied up. They're trying to sort of bargain with the shooter here. And then the assailant stabs them, both of them, multiple times. It's a shocking contrast between the bright scene at the lake and the horrible murder, and because it's daylight, there's no discretion shots or shadow, so it's very raw. Flash forward to Brian sitting in an ambulance, and we see that the Zodiac left a message on the car door in blood. It says the date and by knife.
So, John Robinson, I want to stop and ask you at this point, you know, during the course of this movie, we see the Zodiac killer actually perform several murders, and I'm curious, like, what your reaction was to watching these scenes, because to me, they're incredibly difficult to watch. Very, very painful, obviously. And I don't know that the movie sensationalizes it in any way or is in poor taste in any way, but it's just like, it's tough to balance the idea that like you want to show how brutal these crimes were, but you also don't want to make it into something that's like, you know, violently pornographic in a way. How do you feel the movie right. balances those things?
Well, I think what's interesting for these first two murders, knowing that we were going to talk about it in this way with an eye towards fact versus fiction, I was watching the scene and as it unfolds, I was like, because I couldn't quite remember the details, I was like, somebody has to have survived this encounter. For there right. to be this much detail in here, they have to be going, like, I don't think Fincher and the screenwriter would let so much detail in if they didn't have a firsthand account that they were working off of.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's a quote unquote spoiler for the fact that the men survived the first two attack and are able to give their account of what happened in specific
detail.
Yeah.
The first two attacks that we see on screen, we should be clear. Yeah.
Correct. That being said, the murder in the car at night, you know, is one thing, but the murder at Lake Berryessa, especially the way in which the woman is stabbed, and they mention later that the murderer seems to have lost control when it comes to the women, like a frenzy takes over him. And that's certainly what comes across. I don't know. I think that's important to show the brutality of this, as much as I generally loathe sort of reveling in the grisly details of murders, just to underline how fearful everyone is later. I think that really helps drive home the point of how the entire San Francisco Bay Area was sort of gripped with fear after this case happened. And, it, you know, it's sort of right around the time of the Manson murder. So that's in people's minds. And it's just, I do think it serves a purpose. I don't think it's gratuitous. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they need to kind of get it out of the way almost, right? They need to like show that it's brutal, show that it's like extremely violent. And I mean, I think there's only a few deaths that we see on screen, right? We see the first murder, we see this murder, and then we see the murder in the cab. And then there's that scene with the woman with the baby later. But it's not like there's like you don't see a dozen or two dozen murders during the course of the movie. They do just need to show you that these crimes are really violent and brutal and make the Zodiac out into a fearful character. And I think you're right. It does contribute to what we perceive to be the atmosphere around the Zodiac throughout the course of the movie. I will also just say that this is a situation where watching this movie actually kind of has changed my real life behavior. Like I don't like going into places, like remote places. I've never liked it, but like this movie makes me not want to do that even more because obviously some of the killings happened with like lots of people around, like with the cab driver. But even still, the fact that these people are out in the middle of nowhere with no recourse, I find it to be a terrifying thought or a terrifying concept. This is probably why I never go camping. But yeah, I just think it's like it's very scary the way these crimes take place, and they make it feel like it could be anyone. You know, it could just it's a random person. It could be anyone, and that's what's the most scary about it, I think. So,
yeah, and what I will assure all of you is that if you want to go to Lake Berryessa these days, you would not be able to go there on an empty day. That is a very busy lake, and so like this mysteriously empty day they find at Lake Berryessa is not something you need to worry about anymore. So
it does go to one of the, you know, I've been doing some research as to like why the Zodiac Killer was never found, and one of the reasons that people give is that he was lucky. You know, that there's been many times throughout the course of this movie, even where he barely evades capture, as we'll get to in a later example. But yeah, it is interesting that he goes to this lake. There's no one there to find him. Anyway, back to the movie. We cut to Graysmith drawing the infamous picture of Zodiac pointing the gun, wearing the hood. And then he suddenly remembers something and runs off, which is something that Graysmith does a few times during the course of the movie. He remembers a reference to the Zodiac made in the cipher about the short story The Most Dangerous Game, which if you didn't read it in high school is about a bored rich man who catches shipwrecked people on his island and hunts them as game. So then we get to the other murder that I mentioned. We see a cab driving around with a passenger in the back all in shadow while the radio is reporting on the Zodiac. The mystery person in the cab kills the cab driver by shooting him in the back of the head. The person gets out of the car, runs away, and we hear the voices of someone calling in what they saw happen in the cab.
But a murder in San Francisco proper means we get introduced to Mark Ruffalo's quirky detective, Dave Toski. He's got curly hair, he wears bow ties, and his holster is upside down. He eats animal crackers compulsively. Toski, I should note, is sort of a local Bay Area legend. He inspired a lot of things in pop culture, including the style of Steve McQueen's character in the film Bullet, the Clint Eastwood character Dirty Harry is modeled off of Toski, and Tashi Station in Star Wars is named for Dave Toski. So this is like a very famous Bay Area figure. Toski's partner in the film, Bill Armstrong, is played by Anthony Edwards, and he calls him late at night for the cab murder. They first think it was a robbery and learn that the witnesses are kids who saw it from a window. Toski talks to the kids about what they saw, and in an interesting discretion shot, the film never shows the kids. Kevin Fagan, a crime reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, says the kids as witnesses are less than ideal.
Children are wonderful, but they're terrible witnesses. I mean, they don't know how to evaluate body size, characteristics, you know, colors, dark, light, whatever. So you almost have to discount them as witnesses. And then the cops rush on over there and they have an off description of who they're supposed to be looking for.
But in the end, it's not the kids that mess up the description of the suspect. It's the cops. The original APB says the suspect is black and then it's quickly corrected, but we'll eventually learn that it was not corrected soon enough. The suspect left gloves behind, but they are very small for a male. The fare book says he was let off one block east, so they search around that area.
Yeah, and this is what I was referring to earlier about being lucky. I mean, if that APB had gone out correctly initially, like, right. History might be completely different, right?
He taunts the cops about that very fact. Yeah.
It's such a near miss that they almost could have caught one of the most violent and threatening and mysterious serial killers of all time, but because of a wrong APB, not to be. The Chronicle gets another letter from Zodiac, and Carol, the secretary, screams because it contains a piece of Paul Stein's bloody shirt. This is absolutely real, and they bring in the detectives. The letter threatens to kill a school bus of kids, and they here start to care about the fingerprints and take everyone's prints to find the killer's fingerprints on the letter. Avery is hounding Toski for any more information. He finds out that they got a partial print off of the cab. Graysmith is also starting to get obsessed here, even though he's not part of the investigation or the conversation. Once again, he tries to get into the editorial meeting and eavesdrop on Avery's questions. They decide to run the letter in the newspaper, but take out the threat to the children. Graysmith still decides not to let his kid on the bus that day. So the cops consult handwriting expert Sherwood Morrill, played by Philip Baker Hall, who checks the letters to confirm they're all written by the same person.
The cab driving victim is Paul Stein, and he's the last confirmed victim of the Zodiac. We'll see later other incidents that the Zodiac claims credit for, but this is the last one that the authorities feel certain was actually the Zodiac killer. This crime was also a change in the Zodiac's MO. An expert in the case, Michael Butterfield, talks more about this.
He had called the police, he had sent letters to the media, but the idea that he suddenly changed his MO to killing couples in Lover's Lane spots to killing a lone male cab driver in San Francisco in the heart of a very wealthy neighborhood made this case even more serious and even more terrifying.
All the phones in the police station start ringing, so they need to do a press conference and say something. The survivor from the second attack, Michael Mageau, has disappeared. He got out of town as soon as he could. The real story is that Mageau was perfectly willing to cooperate with police, but unfortunately, he didn't prove a great witness. Here's Butterfield again.
Michael Mageau survived the shooting, and this gave police a lot of hope that he might be able to identify the killer. He did provide some information about the killer's appearance and his vehicle. He said that the car was similar to Darlene's Corvair. However, he admitted to police that he did not get a good look at the killer and that he only saw him briefly in a profile view as he was walking away. This was a tremendous disappointment to investigators.
This is a really, really good scene, I think, a really effective scene in the movie. Showing, not telling, one of the main issues in the case. We've got Bill Armstrong, played by Anthony Edwards, talking to Ken Narlow, played by Donald Logue, and Jack Mullinex, played by Elias Koteas, and they're all sort of cross-talking about what information they have and how they're not sharing it and how they don't have a telefax, and there's weird territorial feelings around things, but there's also this sort of chip on the shoulder from some of the more remote stations about the San Francisco cops getting involved, and it's all a big mess that I think is really effectively done because there's this other action happening in the background where Mark Ruffalo's character, Dave Toski, is talking to their captain, played by Dermot Mulroney, Marty Lee. So there's just like a lot of tension and anxiety around all these miscommunications. What do you make of this element of the film?
Yeah, apparently this is a critical part of why the Zodiac Killer wasn't caught, is he committed his crimes in different counties. And information sharing back then was even worse than it is today. There's no many of these places didn't even have fax. So how would you even send these people information? You need to, like, what, Xerox it and then mail it to them or hand it to them in person. And as you said, there are other political and bureaucratic things that get in the way as well. It does sound like it was genuinely difficult to actually coordinate, putting aside egos and other things like that. And that made it more easy for the Zodiac to evade capture, I think, in the early days there. Yeah, I think it's brought to life really well with this scene with Anthony Edwards just on the phone and trying to figure out how to actually physically get this information to people.
Yeah, and I will say that, like, specifically the stuff that happens in Benicia, Lake Berryessa, Vallejo, these are all, like, still fairly remote areas in California. And so committing this crime, breaking his MO to involve the SFPD is a really interesting move that the Zodiac made. And the film has some questions about why he made it. These rural stations trying to communicate, it's a huge mess.
Yeah, yeah.
But let's circle back to that inaccurate APB from earlier. We see two beat cops that are talking to Toski and Armstrong at the SF police station. The cops say they saw someone suspicious very close to the cab murder that night, but because at the time of the APB, the suspect was described as a black man, and so the cops didn't stop them. But now it's pretty clear that they probably saw the actual murderer.
So Gray Smith is driving in the car with his son. He's still not letting me on the bus. And all they hear is stuff about the Zodiac. Like they're you know, on the radio. They're like going from channel to channel. It's all Zodiac killer stuff. This was before the age of podcasts, so you couldn't really control what ended up on your car stereo. Armstrong once again wakes up Toski because they got a phone call from someone claiming to be the Zodiac, asking very specifically to talk to a lawyer on a call-in morning show. So the two detectives wake up the lawyer, Melvin Belli, who's played by Brian Cox, and they coordinate with the show host, Jim Dunbar. And Belli's hiding in the backseat of the cop car as they drive him to the show. This actually happened, and Jim Dunbar, morning show host, talks about his experience. And in this clip, Jim Dunbar, the morning show host, actually shares about his experience.
The first word I got on the... was a phone call from the Oakland police. I cannot recall now, but I believe it was on a Sunday morning, about 2:30 a.m., that woke me up, and the police said this was the Oakland cops, and they'd gotten a call from some wacko that claimed to be the man. I called Melvin Belli, this legal lion, at probably 3 a.m. in the morning, and he responded immediately, "What time do you want me there?"
So, like, once again, it's really weird to have, like, they're at KGO, which is, like, our local channel, ABC, Channel 7.
It also just feels like a pretty risky gambit to theoretically... First of all, he's saying, like, hey, please don't call in and prank this channel, right? Which is, like, how are people actually... Are they really going to trust people not to do that? And then you're theoretically putting a killer on the air. Who knows what he could say that would be, you know, unpredictable. So it feels like a pretty risky gambit to me when they're doing this.
But yeah, but I think it speaks to their desperation, yeah. Right? That they're just like, there's a serial killer. Everyone is, you know, amped up and scared. And it's like, whatever we got to do to try to stop this, we're going to do. So all the cops and the TV station producers are tense. They're waiting. Finally, someone claiming to be the Zodiac calls in, but something is definitely off. He says his name is Sam, that he's just got headaches, that he doesn't need mental help. So here's Jim Dunbar again.
Well, Belli was rubbing his hands together at the opportunity to get on a television program that was running on top of the market. And I think that's, in fairness, I can't blame him, but I do understand that Mel was anxious to make an appearance on television. Honestly, to be truthful, I thought there was some weirdo out there who was pretending to be Zodiac, who saw an opportunity to make a big splash. And we got our first call, and I said something to the effect of, tell us what's going on in your head right now. And as soon as he began, I think it was at that point that it was Belli who suggested, why don't we call you Sam so we have a name to use?
In the film, the Zodiac hangs up, then calls back so the call can't be traced. He says that if he kills, he doesn't get headaches, and then he lets out a truly chilling scream. Here's Jim again.
Getting back to the shooting kids, he really kind of went into another place on that. He really sort of talked with a delight about killing the kids. The tone kind of changed. I felt that whether or not this was the Zodiac, we had some guy on the phone who apparently had some buried wish to kill kids. And so that was pretty chilling.
The man on the phone agrees to meet Melvin elsewhere, and of course the cops are all over it. Meanwhile, they bring in the second survivor, Brian, and have him listen to the voice. Here's Zodiac case expert Michael Butterfield on what they were expecting from Brian.
Brian wasn't positive that he could identify the killer's voice, but he did believe that if he was presented with a recording of a suspect's voice, he would be able to rule that person out.
And in fact, Brian says the caller is not the same guy that attacked him, but they are able to trace the phone call back to a mental hospital. But the original phone call asking for Bella in the first place sounded different and might have actually been the Zodiac. Butterfield says they were eventually able to identify the person who had called into the show, but his name only showed up in one record, a report written by Paul Avery on the incident. Here's Butterfield again.
Paul Avery wrote like a 19-page report. That's why, you know, in the movie, when there's that scene where they chew out Paul Avery and they say, "Did you really ask the Department of Justice to put you in charge of the Zodiac investigation?" And they use that as a way to like kind of discredit him. That isn't what happened. In real life, he wrote a summary of the case at the request of the guy who was in charge of the case for the Department of Justice. He wrote up that report, and in it, he mentioned the idea that if there was some sort of task force that he would like to participate in it. His report is the only place that mentions the identity of the person who called Melvin Belli.
In the film, they do conclude that the real Zodiac called to set up the meeting, but the man at the hospital ended up calling instead. However, Avery's report also makes it clear that the later calls to Belli's house were also made by the ill man, while the film makes the conclusion that the real Zodiac called Belli. So that's a little bit of a difference from real life to the film.
At the Chronicle the next day, another letter comes in, and with it, another cipher. But this time, Toski and Armstrong are on the scene to fingerprint everyone before they touch it. Graysmith and Avery go out for drinks, and the drink they're having is an Aqua Velva, which looks like I get a headache just looking at that drink that they're enjoying there. And they talk about the case and how ciphers work. We learn that the Zodiac could have easily learned about ciphers from reading just two books. The scene also features one of the running motifs of Avery's descent into alcoholism and his declining health, even though this meeting didn't happen in real life because, again, Graysmith and Avery were barely associated. Toski calls Armstrong. Something the Zodiac wrote implies he has a basement, which is a rarity in California, and they never clarify why that is, but it's because of earthquakes. And this is a moment in the film that I had a question about because I was like, I didn't know, like, it speaks to sort of, I've lived in California almost my entire life. I guess I didn't realize that other people have more basements. like this film really helped me realize my lack of understanding of how many basements there are. Does everyone else in the world have a basement? And
yeah, I mean, you know, growing up in Boston, virtually everyone I knew had a basement. So I guess people in California have fewer basements, or at least at this time period, that was the case.
We had a basement, but it wasn't like technically on, like, because I know of basements from film and television. And like, they're usually like a large room, right? And that's where you like, you tell the kids to go down there and hang out with their friends so they don't bother you, right? Isn't that what basements are? We don't really have those. We have like storage spaces, but like not really like a whole room that you actually put up would actually hang out.
Yeah, or people can like live in basements, you know? So, Ooh. Yeah, it's a whole thing.
Yeah.
It's a whole thing.
Yeah. Well, welcome to my California-based basement ignorance, which I guess confirms what the film is saying. So.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. All right, let's fast forward to Christmas. And the Zodiac sends Belli a letter. Belli calls the detectives and reads it to them. It's a pleasant letter, but it also contains a piece of Paul Stein's shirt. The detectives also find out that the Zodiac has called Belli's house several times. Cut to a woman driving, and it's clear something terrible is going to happen to her. She gets pulled over by a car behind her, and the driver says her wheel is loose. But don't worry, he'll tighten it for her. Of course, he's really loosening it, and a minute after she gets back on the road, the wheel comes right off. The stranger offers her a ride, but he hadn't noticed before she had a baby. They drive along for a minute. It's very obvious something is wrong. And finally, he says, before I kill you, I'm going to throw the baby out the window. And then we kind of fade to black real fast. Pretty terrifying scene. And also, this is another like life takeaway I have from this movie is like, if somebody who you don't know is trying to pull you over, don't pull over. I'm not trying to blame the victim here or anything like that. I think like, you know, who knows what I would have done in that scenario, but like, I'm trying to say this movie has made me more wary of strangers, you know? I'm just like, that's my reaction to this movie.
That scene is chilling, but I think the following scene is even more chilling. So that we should say that Kathleen Johns is played by the actress Ione Skye, who does a great job of, you know, when we see her next, she's in the road and she's screaming and like even more terrifyingly, like we don't see her baby.
Yeah.
This guy is trying to help her and she refused to accept help from this man, this trucker who has stopped to try to help her. But she does start to accept help from a female motorist who stops and approaches her and is asking her questions. And they ask where her baby is. And then she starts to like go off in the woods. And this woman is like, you hid your baby. But then, you know, I'm like, I don't blame her for hiding her baby in the woods. And, you know, and then we see this woman sort of reach out her hand to her. So she tells her story to the police and claims it was a Zodiac. Tom Bruton, who took over the Zodiac case in the 80s, says the incident with Kathleen is perhaps not connected to the Zodiac case.
Yeah, that Kathleen Johns situation is a very interesting case because what was the main reason everybody thought that was a Zodiac attack? It's because when she got back to the police station, very distraught, she had just been kidnapped and she was pregnant at the time. She looks up on the wall and sees a composite of the Zodiac and says that was the guy. Now that composite drawing is very generic. It could fit a lot of people's description.
So we're not detectives. We can't make any conclusions. But apparently Kathleen's story changed a couple times as she was interviewed. And as the film later points out, the letter in which the Zodiac took credit for the crime came after the article about her was published. And the Zodiac letter contained no new details. Someone did threaten this woman, someone traumatized her, but we can't know for certain that it was a Zodiac.
Yeah, that was something that I kind of realized while watching this movie is how hard it would be to actually attribute killings to the Zodiac, given that the lack of physical evidence and given that you don't really know who the Zodiac is, right? That there's crimes that they don't even know if the Zodiac did them or not. There's only a few that they're like kind of confirmed that it's a Zodiac, but like it, because you don't know who it is, you don't even know which crimes to attribute to him. And I thought that's a very interesting thing that the movie brings to light is how hard it is to like attribute a mysterious crime like this, given that there is a serial killer at large like the Zodiac. So we get a montage of various letters that the Zodiac sends in rapid fire. He asks for people to wear buttons with his name and symbol. He starts setting a score and counting the kills he commits. Although, again, it's unclear who he's killed or where. Avery thinks the letters are full of crap and reveals that the Zodiac symbol was stolen off watches with the same name. We should also point out, by the way, that the Zodiac symbol is not just from the watch, but it's also a kind of a universal symbol for the astrological Zodiac, in which the Earth is divided into four quarters. So maybe the Zodiac got it off of the astrological sign and not the watch. We'll never really know. So then we have a scene of Toski and Armstrong sitting in the car talking about how a year later things have kind of wound down. Back at the Chronicle, Graysmith watches on TV as the mayor of Vallejo starts demanding justice for Darlene Farron for the second set of victims. Meanwhile, Avery gets a card from the Zodiac killer with a piece of Paul Stein's shirt. He freaks out and asks for a gun. And meanwhile, everyone starts wearing I Am Not Paul Avery buttons, even Paul, which I thought was a funny touch.
Those buttons were real. And also you can still buy buttons that say, I am not Paul Avery, I am not Avery. And also shirts that say, I am not Avery, or I am not Paul Avery. So, Dave, it's been over an hour in the movie. Uh-huh. Is it time to meet a woman who isn't going to be violently murdered or attacked?
I hope so.
Oh, me too. All right. So Robert Graysmith goes on a date with a woman named Melody, played by Chloe Sevigny. They talk about work the whole time, and Graysmith mentions that Avery is tracking a tip on the Zodiac. Melly wisely points out that it could be an ambush, and Graysmith is so distracted he can't concentrate on the date anymore, and they have to go back to his apartment to wait for the call. Melanie falls asleep on his couch. Somehow this date is going well? Question mark. She also seems really interested in the Zodiac case, so I guess it's meant to be. Avery calls Graysmith and says he has new info. I just want to point out really quickly that if this were a date I were on,
yes, yes,
it would not continue. That is just something.
She says, this is the most interesting date I've ever been on, you know?
Melanie, we could do better. I promise you.
I guess here's a question, right? Like, agreed that the date is pretty terrible. But it is also happening at a point when Zodiac fever is at its height. Like, people are super interested in the Zodiac. It's dominating the only three channels that are on TV. You know, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but you know what I mean? Like, it's everywhere. And so the idea that you would be on a date with someone who would have like some kind of inside connection to who the Zodiac might be, if you're seeing it on the news, and I can see that the proximity to that might be intriguing in some way. So I guess the question for you is there a topic or media subject or whatever for which you would be willing to endure such a terrible date?
Not true crime, not like murder true crime related, because that's just not something, like, despite the fact that we're doing this podcast, that's not something that I generally like spend a lot of time with.
Right.
But like, maybe if someone had a scoop about what, like, movie related, maybe.
Yeah, but like, which movie? Like the new Star Wars movie, or
sure, someone's like, I have a hold of Colin Trevorrow's original script from Episode 9.
Yes, wouldn't that be an awesome date? Is my question.
Sure, I wish then that we saw more the rest of the film. Has Melanie deeply uninterested in the Zodiac case?
Right.
So I wish that were more consistent. I will say, in terms of behind the scenes photos from film shoots, this is actually one of my favorite. You've got Jake Gyllenhaal and Chloe Sevigny like jammed into that telephone booth. What's a telephone booth, you may ask, children? That is where we used to have to go use a telephone. Anyway, so they're jammed into the telephone booth. And then you've got Fincher like just outside the telephone booth, like framing the shot. And it's just a really cool like setup because, I don't know, it's not often you see two movie stars jammed into a telephone booth. So
yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. And Fincher's also notorious for doing like dozens of takes. So might have been pretty uncomfortable in there, but that's one of the things that kind of drives this movie, though, right, is the lack of sophisticated technology to solve this crime. You can't just, you know, text Paul Avery. You have to literally wait by your phone to hear a call from Paul Avery. And I think the lack of, you know, I think that the Zodiac killer, like a case like this, would just not play out in the same way today, obviously, right? We have so much more surveillance and sophisticated technology monitoring people. Like, it just, I'm not saying there are unsolved crimes, but I just feel like someone this out there would be much more difficult for them to remain uncaught. So anyway, like the telephone booth is an interesting reminder of the lack of technology during this time period. In any case, on TV, Toski sees that Avery claims to have info on an older Zodiac murder that happened in Riverside. The handwriting expert says it's the same person. Toski is super pissed off that Avery went to the press before the police. Everyone is on an airplane to go to Riverside to get more info. They find out the victim is named Cherry Jo Bates, and she was last seen leaving a college library. Her father was sent a letter, and a typed confession letter was also sent to the paper to print. Some of the language is the same. Also found is a desk with a weird poem that also matches the handwriting. But Riverside PD doesn't think it's a Zodiac. They maybe think Zodiac just took credit for the murder. Toski and Avery also disagree over this being the Zodiac's work. And, you know, this is, again, part of the earlier point I was making is this movie highlights how difficult it was to know that something was the work of the Zodiac, right? And when you have a case like this, you know, you saw the desk in the movie, Joanna, right? And you saw the little poem written there, and it's like, is that the Zodiac? I mean, the handwriting kind of looks the same as him, and the syntax kind of looks the same. Ultimately, I feel like that's one thing this movie's trying to highlight is the unknowability of some things like who the Zodiac killer is that you can apply to many other aspects of life, right? It has this very postmodernist kind of feel to it, in my opinion. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I have a really much more important question for you, which is, how crazy luxuriously baked that airplane scene feel? There's a point when Paul Avery, Robert Downey Jr. is like walking back to his seat, and you could fit like three Robert Downey Jr.'s wide in that aisle that he's swanning down. And I'm like, is the truth versus Hollywood question I have is, did planes in the 70s between San Francisco and LA look like that or what? Sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, it's okay. I mean, it is true that being on an airplane used to be considered like a very luxurious experience and not merely a painful thing to endure in between locations.
Like I love the overhead note where it's like, remember, I was smoking only in the back four rows of this plane. And they're like, okay, because definitely you can contain the smoke to the back four rows.
Yep, that's how smoke works.
That's how smoke works. So then we find out that Gray Smith, like a totally normal person, has started keeping a scrapbook about the Zodiac. And we get a kind of comic relief montage of people giving tips and claiming to be the Zodiac. And this is what Toski and Armstrong were afraid of in terms of going to the press before going through police. They did not want to get people all up and down the state claiming to know or have seen the Zodiac. So, because clearly most of the people that we see in this film who are talking to them are making it up. Zodiac case expert Michael Butterfield and Chronicle writer Duffy Jennings say that even years and years after the case has been out of the headlines, they still get a ton of people calling in with information, and it's still the same kind of people. First you'll hear from Butterfield, and then you'll hear from Jennings.
Many people are identified as Zodiac suspects, often by amateur sleuths who believe they've solved the case. Sometimes these people are identifying their fathers, their stepfathers, their cousins, their neighbors, their schoolmates. One of the problems with this is that each time a new suspect is named, it gets a lot of attention and a lot of people think that the case has been solved, but shortly thereafter we discover that there's not much to it and the evidence does not implicate them in the crimes.
I left the newspaper in 1980, and I still get a half a dozen emails or phone calls or inquiries a year from people saying, I know who it is, and it's this guy or it's that guy. As you know, we've had instances of people who claim it was their father or somebody they knew.
But not everyone is dismissed out of hand. The detectives get an actual tip that seems to be interesting. The man is Don Chaney, who says an old friend once outlined how he was going to kill people after he lost his job. They now have a plausible lead, a man named Arthur Lee Allen, played by John Carroll Lynch.
And we will follow up on that lead in part two of this podcast.
We talked earlier about how if this project were made today, it would probably be a limited series on TV, on HBO, or on Netflix or something like that. If this were the first half of the story of a series that we were watching on TV, would you, Dave Chen, keep watching?
Interesting question, Joanna. I actually spent the first half of Zodiac trying to figure out what kind of movie I'm watching, right? Because you think it's going to be a murder mystery, and then it's like they're throwing in this question of should these newspapers print this cipher? And then I'm thinking, okay, is this going to be like a media commentary? But then it goes back to being a murder mystery. You're introduced to these cops, and then you're like, oh, they're on track to find him. And there's this kind of propulsive energy to the movie of like, okay, 4 days later, 7 weeks later, 3 years later, you know, it just keeps going, you know, like scene after scene of like, hey, then the next murder happened, then the next thing. And I'm just like, I'm starting to get a little lost in terms of why we're being shown all these things. Like, what is this all adding up to? So I'll just say the answer to your question is I'm not sure, actually, because I think the first half is a little bit more scattershot, in my opinion, than the second half, which I feel like really is anchored by Jake Gyllenhaal's performance. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the power of Zodiac, and this is something we'll get to in part two, is the way in which the questions around this case like destroyed lives and the toll it took. And I'm not just talking about the victims and their families, but also just the people who are trying to figure out the truth and how an elusive truth can just eat away of you from the inside. And you need time in order to do that. You need to watch Robert Downey Jr. go from this like cock of the walk, you know, like dandy to what he winds up as in the movie, whether or not that's based in the reality of the actual Paul Avery. You know, you need to watch the slow toll this takes. And so it is a slow burn. And so I think that it is something that some people might drop off of if that's not something that they're interested in. That being said, I think the thing that feels the most powerful to me in the first half of what we talked about is that confrontation between Mark Ruffalo and Robert Downey Jr. outside the police station in Riverside. Because, you know, these are two actors that obviously would go on to work with each other a lot in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It is kind of a weird thrill to see them here before they did any of that. And Ruffalo is just so good as Toski. Like, his voice is different. We'll see Ruffalo do like a similar sort of very mannered performance in Spotlight. Spotlight is way more mannered, but like that's something that he does. And then Robert Downey Jr. is just doing like a classic Robert Downey Jr. performance. And to see them sort of butt up against each other, like, I kind of want more of that and less of Jake Gyllenhaal going to the library, I guess. And so I think that's the carrot that keeps me going in Zodiac is the hope for more Ruffalo and more of these sort of outsized characters. Brian Cox's character is another one that sort of cropped up around this investigation.
Interesting. Yeah, I think, you know, what I was trying to describe is like, I wasn't really sure what this movie would be about until the second half of the movie. Does that make sense? You know, like, what is this? Obviously, it's about the Zodiac, but like, what is the theme of the movie? What is it trying to say? And at the halfway point, I still don't really know.
Right.
But I think we are going to find out in part two. In part two, Jake Gyllenhaal, who sits on the sidelines for the first hour, he actually gets to get off the sidelines and get into the game himself. But there were a ton of other suspects, and we'll talk about some of them, as well as the legacy of the Zodiac ciphers. And where he is today. No, I'm just kidding. We have no idea where he is. But in any case, Truth vs. Hollywood is an Audio Boom and World Media Rights co-production. It's hosted by me, David Chen.
And me, Joanna Robinson.
It's produced by Audio Boom's Rachel Jacobs, Casey Georgie, Blair Payton, and Lauren Vogel, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights, with help from James Tyndale. I have a show where I interview artists, filmmakers, and other cool people. You can find that at culturallyrelevantshow.com or search for Culturally Relevant in any of your podcast apps. And also the Slash Filmcast at slashfilmcast.com, where I talk about movies on a weekly basis.
You can find me rewatching the 2004 TV show Lost week by week on the Storm Podcast at stormpodcast.com. Also, I will be watching some fun TV shows over on Vanity Fair's Still Watching Podcast.
Feel free to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows, and leave us a review. We'd really appreciate it. It would help this podcast to stand out amidst the crowd. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Truth vs. Hollywood. Stay truthful, people.